Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Nicole Tung has been everywhere, seen everything. The award-winning photojournalist freelances for numerous publications and NGOs, non-governmental organizations. She's worked in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, covering the conflicts in Libya and Syria, focusing on the plight of civilians. Her images, powerful, poignant, impactful. In her words, she's seen humanity at its best, its worst, and everything in between. Nicole spent 2014 documenting the lives of Native American war vets in this country. Those photos landed her a Society of Professional Journalists Award for Best Online Reporting and the Images and Voices of Hope Award of Appreciation. Her work also includes photographing former child soldiers in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the protests in Hong Kong, and the refugee crisis in Europe. To say she has her work cut out is one of life's big understatements. In 2013, Nicole was also named Photo District News, or PDN's, 30 Under 30 Emerging Photographers. Her work has been included in various exhibitions, most recently at the Annenberg Space for Photography in L.A. and the Freilicht Museum in Germany. An American citizen born and raised in Hong Kong, Nicole graduated from New York University in 2009. We're having this conversation via Skype because Nicole is based in Istanbul, Turkey, and I'm here in Manhattan. So, Nicole, hello, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction.
Is chronicling war and conflict the career path you wanted to pursue when you were at NYU? And how did it all begin?
Chronicling war was something that I think was only something I sort of fell into. You know, I was always interested in conflict. I was interested in during my freshman year in college, I took a spring break trip to Bosnia, of all places. And as many people may know, in Bosnia in the 1990s, there was a horrific war. And I was interested in learning what happened to the people in the country a decade after the war, if it had recovered, if, you know, a lot of the tensions were still existing. So I went on a solo trip there. My parents thought I was a little bit nuts. And I met with local NGOs there who led me to locals who had lived through the war and also to a group of women who had fled from this place called Srebrenica, where there was a big massacre there in 1995. And I think from that meeting with these women and hearing their stories and also photographing them really impacted me and made me decide that, you know, going into journalism and photography, using photography in particular, was really what I wanted to do.
Did you document that experience?
I did. I wrote down notes. You know, I was doing a semi-formal interview with many of them, but it was actually the photos that I took on slide film with, you know, a cheap Canon camera that I had with me that, you know, when I got back to school after the break, I developed, and I just felt that the pictures were so much more powerful and said so much more than what I could write in words.
I'm still struck by the fact that you said, I'm not going to go to Daytona on spring break. I'm going to go to Srebrenica. And if your parents thought you were only a little bit nuts, more power to them, because I would have thought you were a lot nuts.
Absolutely. And I think traveling, you know, in Eastern Europe, and my parents had never been to the Balkans. You know, I was also just 19 at the time.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any contacts in Bosnia. So it was just walking into a place completely blind, but I was writing a diary. You know, I didn't feel so alone because I'd met so many people there that shared their experiences with me and were just so warm and open and friendly. And I remember actually going to see a film, and I think it was called Grabovica. It was a Bosnian film about the war and how a child growing up without her father, she never knew who her father was because her mother refused to tell her. And she found out eventually that her father was a Serbian paramilitary who raped her mother, got pregnant. You know, it was this extraordinary film, but it was all in Serbo-Croatian. I didn't understand a word, but I went. Actually, the reason why I went was because there was a high school student who came up to me in a cafe, and he was like, hey, you know, how's it going? What are you doing here? Listen, our school's going to watch this film. Tomorrow, do you want to come? So I got invited to go watch this film with the high school students, and he translated the whole film for me.
Oh, and, you know, isn't whispering that wild?
To me. Yeah, and it was amazing. It was just this amazing experience that I just can't forget.
Does that happen to you a lot as you look over the course of your career, kind of happenstance? You know, you didn't plan running into this young man.
I think so much of what journalism involves is things happening by chance, things happening by luck. You know, you never, and that's what, you know, the old adage in journalism goes, go to everything, because you never know what you'll see or who you'll meet. And I try to keep an open mind. And, you know, I think it's changed a little bit as I've become, you know, as a professional, because you're looking for certain things. Whereas when I was still in college, I was just an open book, you know, I was ready to go anywhere. Whereas when you're working, you kind of have to have a specific end point to, especially when you're doing a story.
Yeah, you have to discriminate more because you can't be everywhere.
Exactly.
So let's go back to college. You come back from this spring break trip. So that's when the seed is basically planted about what you think you're going to do when you graduate?
Yes, I think that I was very confident about, I mean, I knew I wanted a job that allowed me to travel, and people were suggesting, you know, the UN, or my dad was quite a big proponent of going to the UN, but I just didn't feel like that was for me, because I wanted to be impactful, but not in a slow, you know, massive organization sort of way. And so I sort of thought about it a lot. And I also, when I went to my first year of college was in Florence, and because that's just the NYU program. And then, you know, I spent the rest of the 3 years in New York. When I got to New York during my second year, I met a lot of journalists in New York. It's such a great place, you know, to meet everybody. And I met people who became very influential to me, like Chris Hondros and Anthony Shadid, you know, all of the people that were in journalism and actually documenting what I grew up watching, you know, the Iraq and the Afghan wars. I knew all about what I knew about the Middle East or contemporary Middle East in the last 10 years from them. So they greatly influenced, you know, how I approach reporting in the Middle East at the start of my career.
So that's where you headed first?
I was always interested in the Middle East. For some reason, there's this allure about it that I couldn't keep myself away from.
Couldn't shake, huh?
Just can't really explain why. It's just such a fascinating place to me. So I did do some studies in Middle Eastern history at NYU. Had a fantastic professor named Mohammed Bazzi, who was a reporter as well and became a teacher. And he was very encouraging. A lot of the professors at the journalism school were so supportive that, you know, it gave me the confidence to go immediately into freelancing right after graduation. And I didn't go straight to the Middle East. I started freelancing for publications in New York for the Metropolitan section of the Times and other smaller places. And then it wasn't until 2 years later that I really started doing international reporting, and that started with Egypt.
And you went there on your own or under somebody else's auspices?
Well, in this day and age of cutbacks and a lot of closing of foreign bureaus, nobody was going to send someone who was not very experienced. So I did buy my own plane ticket. I said, you know, it was just this jolt in me that I couldn't shake it. I couldn't not go. So I was, you know, watching the events happening first in Tunisia. And when the protests started happening in Egypt, I just said, I have to go. This is my opportunity to cover the region. And if I don't go, I'll regret this. So I bought my own plane ticket, landed in Tahrir Square. I knew a few journalists who were there. So I got in touch with them. But by and large, I was mostly on my own.
That just freaks me out. I admire the courage and the fortitude about that, but I'm more impressed by the confidence.
Thank you.
To go somewhere and just say, you know, it'll work out. I'll make it work. I think that's just, on some level, mind-boggling, but also something to praise. So this is what year now?
Beginning of 2011.
So you're there freelancing, but for whom?
Well, I did get in touch with various publications that I'd already freelanced for. But by the time I got there, there was a lot of media, you know, there. So it was saturated. The whole story was covered from a lot of, you know, different angles and for a lot of publications. So it was very hard to break into the niche of, you know, trying to shoot on assignment. I offered up pictures on spec to several publications, but, you know, many were already publishing images from photographers they knew or from The Wire.
Sure.
So then I started hearing about the protests happening in Libya. And I
You said, I'm out of here?
Yeah, I'm out of here. But, you know, I don't really have a clue what, you know, Libya is like or what's going on for mm-hmm. what has been happening in the country for the last 40 years. I mean, I knew that it was being run by a dictator and that it was a very, almost like a North Korea-style state.
Right.
But I basically took public transportation up to the border on my own and somewhere along the way met up with some journalists, but then ended up on the border crossing on my own where a Human Rights Watch emergencies director just looked at me and said, what are you doing here by yourself? I was like, I'm going to Libya. He's like, all right, okay.
Out of my way, I'm going to Libya.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, all right, I don't think you really know what you're in for, but he wasn't demeaning. He was very concerned and he's become a very good friend. His name's Peter Bouquet, and he basically said, listen, come into my car. You might be able to shoot some pictures for us, but just I don't really want you going in by yourself. And that's how my whole time in Libya started. I ended up spending almost a year there covering the conflict.
You had to be an anomaly, both in Egypt and in Libya, not only by virtue of your gender, but by virtue of your age.
It's a funny question. You know, actually, this generation and the generation covering the Arab Spring has been very different from many of our predecessors in journalism. This really has been a generation of young freelancers going directly into the places, often without assignments like I did, and covering it as well as they can, and many publications taking our work. Now, this is because many of the publications and, you know, newspapers, magazines no longer have the budgets to send in their own staff, but also, at least in 2011, 2012, and even early 2013, there was this sort of idea that the freelancers were really good at what they were doing on the ground and that there was actually less responsibility for the publications. And they were okay with that. You know, they were happy to take our work and not bear a lot of responsibility for, you know, the contributors. And that all changed when things started going very sour in Syria.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is photojournalist Nicole Tung. Before we get to Syria, I read that it was in Libya where you met James Foley. Talk to me about that friendship and that professional relationship.
Well, I met Jim in this little conference room of the hotel that we were all staying at with terrible internet. You know, all the journalists, you can imagine this stuffy room. Everyone's smoking. Everyone's like sitting, staring at their laptops, tapping away, complaining about, you know, the internet. And that's where he came up to me and said, hey, I'm Jim, in this very straightforward fashion. And he said, you know, what are you doing here? I said, oh, I'm a freelancer. We introduced ourselves. He said, listen, I'm going up to the front line. If you need a ride, you know, and if you want to pitch some pictures to the Global Post, who he was working for at the time, you know, let's give it a shot. So he was really forthcoming with me and really open and helpful.
Let's just refresh most people's memories if James' name doesn't ring a bell. And of course it should, that you teamed up in 2011 in Libya and subsequently you both went to Syria and that's where he was captured by ISIS. It was on Thanksgiving Day, right, in 2012?
Yes, that's correct.
And the images will forever be seared in our minds with him kneeling next to Jihadi John, who was, of course, threatening to behead him. And that's exactly what his fate became in August of 2014. So I'd like you to take us on your relationship and your friendship and your working with him over the course of those 3 years.
I got to know Jim a little bit in Libya. I didn't get to know him very well, but I had met him in this time where, you know, there was journalists everywhere in Benghazi, at least in the east of the country, where the rebels and the opposition had taken control from the Gaddafi government. And Jim just struck me as this very, you know, gung-ho, positive, and very warm and, you know, affectionate, caring person. He was spending most of his time with another group of freelancers. I spent my time with other journalists. So, you know, we saw each other and we exchanged a lot of conversations and we exchanged emails when we were both in and out of the country. But it wasn't really until the end of 2011 and the beginning of 2012 where we just started discussing about going into Syria. And I think the turning point for many of us wanting to cover Syria was when Marie Colvin, a very veteran and seasoned war correspondent was killed in Homs in Syria in early 2012 alongside another French photographer. A lot of the international media pulled out their staff, decided not to cover Syria, you know, extensively or, you know, just because of the safety issue. And I think for a lot of freelancers, we saw this void that needed to be filled and there needed to be independent reporting coming from Syria. So Jim and actually John Cantley, who he was captured with in 2012, actually did their own first trip in early 2012. And then Jim and I decided to go sometime around May of 2012. You know, we wanted to team up together because traveling solo inside was really a difficult and dangerous task. And also as a woman, I didn't want to be traveling by myself.
Oh, hello. So, yeah. I mean, that's what's running through my mind here. I mean, you're in an area that at the very least is not particularly female friendly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't even that I didn't trust the Syrians, right? I trusted them with my life. You know, the people who took us in, it was more just when we were meeting with more conservative people or going into, you know, military areas. It's just such a patriarchal society where, you know, they're not sure how to treat foreign women. So they would prefer to speak to the man that's with you.
Sure.
And so Jim really helped break the ice with a lot of people we were meeting. And in the professional relationship, I really looked to him to get us in a lot of access sometimes. You know, sometimes I had access to the women that he couldn't access. And so really it became this great working relationship. And, you know, our friendship developed, and it was, you know, we often would have to cover very horrific bombings and airstrikes by the regime in civilian neighborhoods. And I think there's a bond that you forge with people that in a conflict, when it comes to certain situations that you just, you don't form with your friends back home, you know, and it's like,
well,
it's
the stakes are so different.
Exactly. And it's like veterans coming home and missing their buddies and missing the idea of war because they had this camaraderie that they shared. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of reporters experience too.
So you cover Syria, and do you come back to the States at all, or are you just pretty much there?
I didn't really go back to the U.S. in 2012 except for it's what we called battlefield medical training for journalists. And it was basically to teach freelancers how to treat wounds and, you know, gunshot wounds and shrapnel wounds and things like that when you're in the middle of a conflict situation. But for the most part, I was between Turkey and Syria in 2012. I would come out to Turkey, take a little bit of R&R, and then I would go back into Syria to keep working.
So he subsequently is kidnapped. And are you aware of that as soon as it happens?
I was the first person aware of him being kidnapped because actually the day that him and John Cantley were supposed to come out, I was going to meet them at this border town. I was waiting for them in Turkey. I had messaged him over email several times. We had exchanged, you know, meeting points and just times. And I was expecting him to call me at about 4:35 p.m. in the afternoon. And when he didn't call me, I frantically started calling all of his phones, his satellite phone, you know, everybody's phone that I knew who to call, and couldn't get a response until I spoke to our fixer, our translator, that evening. I called him at home. And when he picked up the phone at home, I just said, Mustafa, our translator, Mustafa, what are you doing at home? Shouldn't you be on the road? Shouldn't you be here in Turkey? He said, the first thing he said was, I'm really sorry, but John and Jim have been kidnapped.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's when the ball started rolling. And, you know, the first 24 to 48 hours are crucial when a kidnapping happens because that's when you can try to find out the most information. But in this case, it just seemed like they had disappeared into thin air. I had to make a decision to contact the family, to contact Jim and John's family.
Oh, wow.
You know, at first I spoke to colleagues and I said, listen, this has happened. I don't have any information. Should we wait through the night to see if we get any information before contacting their families first thing in the morning? Because we didn't want to cause unnecessary panic.
Sure.
Because if maybe they had been returned, in a few hours, or there was some little piece of information, we could at least offer that to them as some sort of consolation. So we decided to hold off until the morning, and a close friend of Jim's was the one to call Diane Foley, and I spoke to John's family as well.
So what were those 2 years like for you?
Oh, it's those first 2 years, or the first year actually, was a blur because it was all sorts of confusion. There was a lot of people who wanted to offer up information, but many of those leads were dead ends. And also there were people who were trying to offer up information for their own benefit because maybe they thought there was money that could come out of it. You know, there was just all sorts of things that we couldn't be sure of. And it was very hard to search for information because we couldn't really go into these areas. It was starting to get really vicious, this mm-hmm. war. And a lot of people were very afraid to talk because they knew that the Islamist groups were becoming very powerful. So they didn't want retribution from these groups if they spoke to us about these missing journalists or if they inquired about it even. So the first year, there was really no information at all about their whereabouts. We had no idea who had them. I had a gut instinct that it was, Islamic extremists, but without facts or without any piece of information coming out, it was very difficult to discern. There was a big campaign from the Foley family to reach out for information for Jim. And on the other hand, there was a media blackout over John Cantley's name because there were concerns about there was an active case going on in the UK concerning his first kidnapping. He was kidnapped once before in Syria earlier in the year, in July of 2012.
I would have to think that the feeling of impotence must have been overwhelming for you.
Absolutely. You know, I was there on the border. I was so close to seeing him. And actually that drive should have only really taken an hour or so from where he was inside of Syria to the Turkish border where I was going to meet him. And to feel like you're so close to that person and he didn't make it, you know, I was frantic and I felt this huge weight of responsibility, and I felt a sense of guilt because actually I had just been with him the week before. And the reason why I wasn't with him on that trip was because I had issues with my cameras. And that's why I left to go fix them. So I had this sense of guilt, you know, that I should have been with him.
I understand.
And I just couldn't find any leads. And it was very frustrating. His family, his brother, Michael in particular, Jim's brother, was also, more probably frantic because it's his brother. But we were both trying very hard to find the right contacts, be in touch with everybody, and just reach, cast a very wide net, but ultimately didn't come back with anything.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is photojournalist Nicole Tung. How did this experience, how has it impacted your life and your work?
I think that this experience of losing a very close friend, and it wasn't the first time I lost friends, it gives you a huge pause. You know, you think, okay, is it worth my life going into certain places when many people don't even really care about these stories, you know? And it's a very big generalization. I mean, it's very hard to make people care about a country halfway across the world that, you know, they've never heard of or don't really have an interest in. But I think, you know, losing someone personally just made it, I could empathize with what people were going through. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in a way how it's impacted my work is I've been less willing to be the big risk taker I was when I initially started. You know, when I was 24, I was going into Libya, I was ready to do anything. Mm-hmm. And I was very, so green. But over the period of 5 years, I've really toned that down and said, okay, I'm a lot more calculating, I think. I've matured very quickly about doing this kind of reporting. And, but on the other hand, you know, I think Jim's death has propelled me more than ever to say that this kind of reporting is more necessary than ever.
That's what keeps you going.
Yes.
Do you feel like you're on a mission?
I mean, I don't want to characterize what I do as a mission, because there are very clear-cut rights and wrongs. And when I was covering something like Syria, when on a daily basis we were seeing children and women and just civilians in general streaming into hospitals, victims of airstrikes, you know, missing limbs, missing every, you know, it was just wrong. And you have to report that. There's nothing right about it, you know. And I think also with photographs, I try to convey, obviously, what's happening in front of me, and I want people to decide what they think of it. So, yeah.
What about the futility of this war that's been going on for what seems to be forever? Does that eat at you? When is this going to stop already?
I think that the futility of this war has been so frustrating for the reporters covering it, because you go in with this idea that maybe your reporting or your pictures will affect some kind of change, no matter how small. And in some ways they have, you know, very small on the ground changes, like bringing in medical aid to this particular town or mm-hmm. something. But on a larger scale, you feel like you're just shouting in the dark, because everything happens on the political level. And if the political level willed things to stop and for things to just calm down a little bit, then it could happen. But it really, yeah, I think that you cover this day in, day out, or you are constantly looking at the news, and, you know, but it never stops. And it's just, you feel weighed down, and you feel guilty that what you tried to do as a reporter didn't change anything. And that can be quite, it can eat away at you, but I try not to let it.
And I think it's also the frustration of how things just move so glacially when it comes to government.
When you think about Syria, not even Syria, but so many conflicts that last for years, it eats away at the society. It eats away at you know, the threads that make up a society. And when we look at Syria, you know, all of this culture and history, not even just human lives, but, you know, 250,000 plus lives being lost, but the, you know, history is just disappeared. I remember walking through the old city in Aleppo, and just, I could smell, you know, the soap, the olive soap they're so famous for making. I could still smell it. And in the background, I could hear bombs being dropped. You know, it was just a very bizarre feeling.
What do you see in your future? You're based in Istanbul now. Are you going to pretty much stay in the region for the near future?
I certainly hope to. I think that there's so much to be covered in this area, not just conflict. You know, I don't want to just portray this region as an area that is rife with conflict, because people still live here. You know, everybody has to go to work, and they farm, and they just like they do in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I want to communicate those stories and the stories that bear similarities across cultures.
But you're experiencing problems, are you not, in Turkey? You know, there's trouble there as well.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a little difficult to cover, but I certainly think that this country is so pivotal in this region that we're going to have to try to find a way to cover what's going on.
So if I was your fairy godmother and I said, okay, Nicole, what would you like to do next professionally? What images do you want to photograph next?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I hope that in the next 5 years, 5-6 years, that I'm still going to be covering the kinds of stories that I feel are not given enough particular attention. And one of them is actually about former child soldiers demobilizing from militia groups. And I don't know what's going to happen after that, but I do hope to stay in this field of things, whether it's journalism or human rights advocacy. I don't know yet, but I certainly want to stay, in the field.
Well, we want you to stay in the field, because without Nicole Tongs, the world would be a very different place. And the fact that you're educating all of us and exposing all of us is worth volumes.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing my story and all the other women's stories that I was listening to earlier. So thank you very much.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have an idea for an interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.